All right. Welcome back to the podcast. My name is Doug, and I'm a grateful believer in Jesus and a recovering sex addict. And this is episode 88, part B. So if you have not listened to part A, we would suggest that you go back and listen. It should be the episode right before this one, just a couple of days ago, where you can listen to part A and hear Ian's story, hear the beginning of his journey. And I guess I should say this is 88 part A-ish and B. So we're going to wrap up our part A, and then we'll jump into part B. So welcome back to the podcast, Ian.
Thank you, Doug.
I am excited to hear the rest of your story, as probably people have heard me say a lot. I love part Bs. I love hope. I love freedom. I love showing guys out there that these darkest times that we talk about are not the last thing, that there's more to come. But with your story, we were talking about roughly right about the time you were getting married. And so, you know, we were talking, is this where it all stopped? And of course, you're like, no, there's a lot more to come. And so that's where we want to dive in today. So if you want to pick up with that aspect, let's jump off there.
Absolutely. So I met my wife, and she was different than everyone else I had met. She was beautiful. She was spiritual. She was kind. She was humble. And I said, you know, this is the woman I want to marry. And I thought that it would cure my addiction. But keep in mind, at this time, I didn't acknowledge that I was an addict. I knew kind of I had a problem, but I had never really realized the extent of it. So I got married. And before I got married, my wife made a big point to tell me how she felt about strip clubs. And she made sure to tell me that I was going to Las Vegas for my bachelor party, and under no circumstances would I be allowed to have or go to a strip club, because she considered that cheating. And I kind of agreed to it, and I said, you know, I won't do that, honey. I promise I won't. And literally, I didn't, and I had a very wholesome bachelor party filled with booze and debauchery in other ways, but certainly not sexual related. And a few days later, I get back to Los Angeles, and I decide on my own to go to a strip club and basically hide that from my wife, because she wasn't my wife yet, and that was going to be the last hoorah. And I could honestly tell her I didn't go to a strip club at my bachelor party. And I proceeded to go spend $1,000. And I had forgotten all about this until I got into disclosure and had to go back to my records and found it. So clearly I was still in some serious denial. So I get married, and I decide, you know, I'm really going to try not to go to strip clubs anymore. But certainly I wasn't going to stop looking at pornography or doing any of the other things that I had been doing. So I decide to go in and make sure that I tell my wife and, you know, make sure that she knows that I am a wholesome guy, that, you know, I struggle with addiction, but all that's behind me. And I never acknowledged the fact that I had anything to do with sexual addiction, or had seen prostitutes, or had gone to these strip clubs. I said, you know, when I was single, I messed around, but all that's behind me. And during the first, I would say, 6 years of our marriage, a couple incidents stand out. But what I did is I continued to go to strip clubs, and I did it when I was out of town. I didn't tell her about it, and it was, as far as I was concerned, it was very much something I did to reward myself for working hard, and she didn't need to know about it. What she didn't know wouldn't kill her. And so I continued to kind of do these things, and I'd say maybe I did it once every 3 or 4 months. You know, and I considered that okay. I said, you know, I got this under control. I just do it here and there. But then I started adding massage parlors to the mix as well, and I didn't tell her about that. And every time I went to a massage parlor, I kind of thought, well, I'm not doing anything. That's just part of the massage. And, you know, in the back of my head, I was thinking, you know, I know I shouldn't do this during marriage, but, you know, I'm not initiating it. They're doing it. So I still had these rules that, you know, where things were acceptable if I didn't kiss somebody, or if I didn't, you know, have sexual intercourse with them. And a couple times during my marriage at bachelor parties, I actually pushed the limit, and I you know, did things that I watched it progress from, you know, from what I thought was semi-innocent to things that were blatantly not not okay. But I still didn't break my two rules that I had set for myself. So it was kind of like I was getting very drunk and doing things and pushing the limit. That I, after the incident, I was like, that never happened, and I will never speak of that again. I'm going to take this to my grave. So there were a couple times during bachelor parties where I clearly pushed the limit. And then things like, you know, going dancing with friends when I was out of town and taking off my wedding ring. All these things were unacceptable in a marriage, but I just kept them all secret. And so for me, it was like, well, look, I don't have a girlfriend. I don't have an affair partner. I'm just having fun. I'm flirting. I'm going to, you know, strip clubs, massage parlors. This is what guys do. And that continued for, I would say, the bulk of the marriage, along with continuing to use pornography on a, you know, fairly regular basis, and also going on webcams and looking at webcams. So I am essentially living a double life at this point, where my wife sees me as this wholesome, good man, and I'm meanwhile, cheating on her.
Let me stop you for a moment. Like, you're doing, like, you're going out dancing, or you're going to bachelor parties and that kind of thing. What's your friend group? Like, are they like, we'll lie for you, or they just don't care? They don't know that side of your life. Like, tell me about that part.
Yeah, it was a secret. I didn't tell anyone. So when I get out of town, I go to a massage parlor by myself. You know, I found the ones in the areas when I travel. I go to strip club. This was something that I really kept a secret. My friends had known when I was single that I used to do this stuff. But when I got married, I definitely considered this, you know, taboo, and I didn't want anyone to know about it. So I really kept it from everybody, including my closest friends. I didn't have acting out partners. In fact, this is something that I kept, I didn't have partners or friends that I acted out with. It's something that I did in secret and kept hidden from everyone. This is something I basically was a skeleton in my own closet that nobody got to know about.
Yeah, I just was curious about, like, those bachelor parties or things like that, like if what that friend group was that you were there with.
Yeah, the bachelor parties, they were all married, and for the most part, you know, it was pretty, I didn't have friends that struggled with any compulsive sexual behavior in that regard, or at least not that I was aware of during the time of my marriage. But certainly at bachelor parties, I think the wives that friend group didn't consider, they were not as religious as my wife, and certainly didn't consider that cheating. I think their wives were okay with them going, knowing it was the bachelor party one time kind of thing. So those were a few incidents, but for the most part, all of my acting out that I did outside of just the two bachelor parties I went to was done in secrecy, Doug.
Okay. Yeah, that's good context. I just, I'm always a little curious about that. And just, you know, there's so much of an addict's behavior that is about secrecy and lying and, just curious what that was. And it's interesting to bring it out that really the majority of it for you was this secrecy that you kept from everyone. And I think that's, you know, sometimes a fear that I've heard that spouses have is just that, like, we have this network of people that were lying for us as addicts. But in truth, we were lying to the world. I mean, we're lying to ourselves too, but just to pretty much everyone.
It wasn't something I was proud of, put it that way. I didn't want people to know that, especially being a married man now. You know, I did not want people to know. In fact, I would, you know, there was one time I went to a strip club and I literally put my phone away. So my wife, she was out of town and she called, you know, she couldn't track it. And I took a ride sharing app to hide it so that if she ever got in my ride, I was very secretive about it. And I just really tried to cover my tracks. And, you know, I did get caught one time. This was back 2 years ago when I did go to a strip club. I was very drunk, and I came home at 4 a.m. And my wife was there, and I slept on the couch downstairs. She didn't wake up, but she comes in at 7 a.m. and she just, it was like, where were you? And I'm like, I went to a strip club. I told her. I didn't lie about it because I wasn't able to lie. It just wasn't in the place where I could have come home at 4 a.m. and been anywhere else because the bars closed at 2. So I told her the truth, and she was devastated. She was crying. She was hysterical. And she said, you know how I feel about that. You know, why would you go and, you know, look at other women and have them dance on you? And, you know, it was just heartbreaking to see her. And at that point, I decided to get some therapy. I decided to get help and saw the therapist a few times and thought I was cured. And then sure enough, a few months later, I was back at it again, hiding and doing it out of town, even though I knew the impact of my wife. I figured, well, she's not going to find out again. There's no way. And now I was even more secret about what I was doing because I knew firsthand how it impacted her, having seen how upset she was by that. So, you know, that was really, until discovery, that was really kind of how things were going throughout my marriage for the better part of 7 years.
Wow. And then looking backwards now, do you see how that would have piled on more shame, or what that would have brought on to feel like now I have to be even more secret? Like, what were, you know, some of those emotions that you were feeling at the time?
I think I was in such denial, Doug, that I'm like, you know what? She's not going to know about it. This is for me. It was almost like the thought, the mere thought, and the impulsive part of I'm going to go. It almost made it more exciting in some ways, where I knew I was doing something bad, and I knew, you know, that I shouldn't be doing it. And it was like this other person took over. It was like I'm fully in the addiction in those moments where I really wasn't thinking about my wife. I was thinking more about how to get away from it, or get away with it. So it was the fact that I had these secrets made it very, very easy to continue piling more secrets on. I'll tell you that, because I knew that if she found out, you know, I knew what the implications would be. And so I just really didn't focus so much on getting help and wanting to get better for her. I just more focused on, you know, trying to do it a little less. And when I did do it, not getting caught. That was kind of where my head was at the time.
Yeah, you just said something that really caught my attention with, you know, feeling like if you could basically, you said it better than I'm going to say it now, but if you could lie once, it just became this like snowball of, well, I just might as well just keep lying. And I just think that's such a shared thought process of broken thinking that so many addicts have, of just like, well, I've already been lying for years, so what's one more? Or what's, you know, continuing this? It's easier than trying to correct all these lies. And I just really think that's Satan, and that's just those broken thoughts trying to keep us in that addiction cycle and not finding the help that we need.
You got it, Doug. And, you know, you're not doing something that bad. You know, that I'm not cheating, right? That was what I kept telling myself. Cheating means having a girlfriend. That's why I wanted to come on the show, because I was as much a sex addict as anyone, but I had my own rules. And the bottom line is what's not okay is lying. And Jesus in the Bible is very clear that you love your wife as Jesus loved the church, and you are one person. When you get married, you form one unity. And I was not living that way. And any kind of secret in any marriage, regardless of what the addiction is going to be detrimental if you don't truly know your partner. So that was definitely the lie I was living. And that continued for a while until It was March of 2019, a couple of years ago, when things really got bad and the addiction started to escalate a little bit. So I was in Las Vegas again at a work conference, and I had been drinking, you know, heavily and gambling heavily, and I was walking back to my hotel room. I had zero money in my wallet because I had spent it all gambling, and I was on my way up to the hotel room, and two women approached me in normal street clothes, and they said, "Do you want to have some fun?" And I told them, I don't have any money, I'm sorry. And like, well, you can pay us via Venmo, which is a payment app. And it was called Zelle. It was a payment app called Zelle. And I said, well, I have Zelle. And I kind of like, at that point, I knew it was wrong. I knew that nothing good had happened, but I said to them, well, what are we going to do? He's like, well, we'll just dance. We'll just have a little fun. I'm like, okay, what's the harm? And sure enough, I get up there, and the whole time I'm thinking, I shouldn't be doing this. And I was in the room with two women, and that's when I crossed my own line. And that's when I proceeded, you know, to not only have them dance for me, but to have them be, you know, intimate with me. And at that point, I proceeded to getting oral sex from them, which was something that I was not okay with, that I never wanted to have happen. And I remember just hysterically crying afterwards, you know, saying what I might have done. And I'm sitting there with these two prostitutes in Vegas crying my head out. And they're like, no, you're fine. You didn't cheat. You didn't do anything. That doesn't count. And you know, and I, and I, I called, you know, someone that a mentor, a psychologist, and I said, I need help. I think I did the worst thing. And that person told me, you know, take it to your grave, you know, just don't do it again. So I continued to kind of.
Wait, so the advice you were given at that point was just, it's easier to not talk about it again?
Yeah, just don't ever do it again. You know, you, what's done is done. You could break up your marriage if you tell your wife that, because I didn't know whether to tell her or not, because, you know, getting prostitutes in Las Vegas, regardless of what you're doing, that to me, I had crossed the line. You know, that was something I said I never would do. I never would engage with prostitutes. If I was at a strip club or a massage parlor and they did something, you know, that was kind of just part of the establishment. But for me to go solicit and to pay, you know, prostitutes for any kind of services was for me crossing my own line. So I ended up carrying this immense shame and guilt, you know, throughout 2019, where I did want to tell my wife. And, you know, even with all that shame, it still continued. And so past that time, I kept that secret. And there were a few months I wanted to tell her, but I didn't know how, and I was so scared. And so I said, I'm never going to do this again. And then I remember she went out of town, and I went to maybe a strip club and two massage parlors within a week. And I'm like, I got to get help. I need to get help. I'm going to an SA meeting. And I drove myself to an SA meeting. And that was kind of the first time I was introduced to recovery. But at this point, my wife still didn't know anything in my story. So going there, I get to the SA meeting. And they said, I'm not allowed to look at pornography again or masturbate. And that was the condition. I said, I'm out of here. I can't do this. And I'm going to continue to hide the secret. So I'm going to fast forward because I want to get onto the recovery part. But my, you know, my come to Jesus moment was February 13th, and that was over a year ago. And I wanted to tell my wife about what I had been doing. I wanted to tell her and confide her that I had a problem, but I didn't want to tell her everything. And so I started talking about porn and telling her I'd been watching porn and kind of what she thought about that. And she's like, well, I'm not okay with it. Why are you telling me this? I'm like, well, what do you think of webcams? What do you think of people, you know, stripping? You know, I know you don't like strip clubs, but what about like a virtual strip club, like where people are dancing in a chat room? Would you be okay with that? Mm. And she said, absolutely not. Is that something you've been doing? And I said, yeah, I have actually. And in my mind, I'm giving her a little bit. I'm giving her something, but not the full thing.
So do you feel like at this point you're testing the water, so to speak? Like, is this going to be something I can fully confess? I mean, you feel like that's what's going on at this
point? Yes, exactly. Yeah. I felt guilty about Vegas and crossing the line with the prostitutes, and so I wanted to, like, tell her something so I can at least ease my own guilty conscience, right? And so I was I was testing the waters. And she's like, well, how often have you been going on webcams? And I said, well, it was probably a couple dozen times, you know, nothing crazy. And she said, what? And I'm like, yeah, is that a big deal? And she's like, well, I'm not okay with that. She started yelling, and we kind of put the rest. I'm like, okay, I won't do it anymore. I just wanted to see how you felt. I'm sorry. I didn't, in my mind, it was just fantasy. I didn't think there was anything, you know, wrong with that. I thought it was better than physical strip clubs, but now I won't go anymore. And so I promised her. She was really upset, and I left. And then I came back later that day, and I saw her in bed, and she had all of my credit card statements open. She had been going through my credit card statements, and she had everything circled from this website that anonymized the data of all the times that I had paid for going on in a chat room and paying women to strip virtually, which was kind of another form of my acting out. And she was infuriated with me. And she looked up and she said, what have you been doing? Who are you? What's wrong with you? How could you do this? And she just started wailing and crying. And then it turned really, really, really scary. She started shaking uncontrollably. And she started trembling and went to a ball in the corner of my room and was crouched up like a child. And then she started contracting. She was 4 months pregnant, and she started having contractions. And she said, Ian, something's wrong. I'm feeling like the baby's going to come right now. And she started having these, you know, contractions. And at that point, I knew my life would never be the same. My wife was 4 months pregnant, and we got in the car and we rushed to the doctor because we thought she was going into early labor. And in 4 months pregnancy, you can't have a baby survive right. that premature. He would have died. And she had already had a miscarriage the previous year. And the entire ride over, I was just praying to God. I said, God, please don't take this baby. Please don't hurt my wife. Please, please, please. I will do anything you ask. I promise you, I will do anything to get better. Just please don't take this baby. And we had already had a son, so she knew what labor contractions felt like, and she was having full labor contractions. They were coming faster and faster. So we get to the doctor, and my mom meets us there because she's scared too, and she lived nearby. And the doctor put his device on her stomach to see if the baby had a heartbeat. And he's feeling around, and I swear it felt like it must have been 30 seconds, but it felt like 30 years in that moment. Mm. And he looks up and he's like, the baby's okay. There's a heartbeat. And I remember my mom, like before the doctor even spoke, she said, is the baby dead? Is he dead? Because she couldn't wait for the doctor to say. And I still remember that. And he said, no, it's a heartbeat. And he's like, what's going on with her? He's like, these are stress contractions. Your wife has been put under so much stress that her body is going into contractions. And that's her way of physically dealing with stress. They're not labor contractions. The baby's going to be okay. And he gave her some anxiety medicine. And that was when, at that point, I said, I don't care what it takes. I don't care what I have to do. I am going to get help. And I started looking online, and I looked at podcasts because that was something I enjoyed, and I found Castamonia. I went online, I found SAA, and that was kind of what started my journey into recovery. But unfortunately, God gets your attention, and you know, he tests you, and I think whatever needs to happen to bring him back to you is what's going to happen. And unfortunately for me, it took that rock bottom to get me to turn to God and Jesus and get into recovery for real. And fortunately, I've been sober since that day. It's been over a year now.
Man, praise God for that sobriety. But wow, what a powerful story. And just, I mean, I even had like a reaction to just picturing what that would have been like, you know, for your wife's reaction, because it connects to reactions that I saw in my own wife. And just knowing that physically you can cause that kind of reaction from pain and from stress, that you know, the things that I promised for so long, and it sounds like that you promised for so long, that wouldn't quote unquote hurt anyone, hurt people badly. And you know, I don't say that to heap on guilt for listeners that are out there, and certainly, you know, we understand pain, and we understand, you know, that our actions have consequences. But I think moments like this are sobering, and I use that word intentionally, because they bring reality to the situation of, if we live in a fantasy world, whether it's pornography or strip clubs or affairs, this fantasy world that tells us, hey, this is just fun and it doesn't hurt anyone, that we need a little dose of reality to bring us back to sobriety. And so it's a sobering thought. And that's just something that hit me there for sure. And it's not something that I wish on anyone or wish that you'd have gone through, but I'm grateful that there was a precipitating factor that got you into recovery. And we call those rock bottom moments. You know, that's what, when everybody hits their rock bottom, and that is, sounds like where yours was.
It was a fall beyond anything I could describe, and I am grateful too. I echo your sentiment. I'm grateful. I wouldn't wish that I caused my wife any harm or pain, but I'm grateful because it brought me to God. It brought me to purpose. It brought me to recovery, and it brought my marriage to a place better than it ever has been. And I can say that now. I mean, I'll talk about what happened afterwards, but the reality was that this was just the start of my recovery. I didn't know how to go and where to go and what to do from there, but I did know that what my wife had experienced from this pain was something that I, on the scale of what I had done, considered probably a 3 or 4, going on webcams compared to going to physical you know, massage parlors and acting out and in ways that she didn't even know about. So it just brought home the reality is, man, if I could have hurt her that badly with webcams over the internet with someone I've never interacted with in person, I just can't imagine what, you know, what would happen if she actually knew what I really had done and to the extent of what my acting out was, because that just hit home for me. It's like, man, that she had that reaction from that, man, it would kill her if I told her, you know, that I had been doing it before. So this was kind of just my entry, but that, at that point, that's when I committed fully to, you know, to the journey of recovery.
Hmm. And so there's a couple parts that I want to dive into, like the first being, how did you get from that element of that fear of, like, I don't want to say more than this because I already know how much I hurt her. How did you get to where you could disclose more? I want to talk about that. But I also want to talk about your journey of your faith. And, like, what is your faith journey at this point doing? Where were you in your addiction? Was there faith that was a part of what you espoused to be and you just didn't really believe that? Like, what was that element as well? So maybe if we talk about faith first and then we'll jump into the other.
Yeah, so I'll talk about faith first because it was God that brought me to recovery without a doubt, and specifically that brought me to Christianity. And I'm not judging other faiths, but Christianity was something that was new to me, and I was raised Jewish, and all of the principles of what I was taught in Casamonia and through my sponsor. So the first SAA meeting I went to, and if this isn't divine intervention, I don't know what is, was led by a pastor. And that pastor said things to me like, you know, we are not our actions. God forgives us. And through Jesus, you will find forgiveness, and you need to atone. And you know, we are made to sin. We are made of the flesh. And when you're walking in God's will, it's different than walking in man's will. And the whole idea that this whole lifetime I was chasing tail and chasing money and chasing ego, and God's the fruit of the spirit versus the fruit of the flesh, was really this world that I'd never been exposed to or didn't know anything about, was really appealing to me. It was not just appealing, that's not the right word. It made sense. You know, I always thought to myself, why do I do the things I do? What is wrong with me? And when I understood that humans are sinful by nature, and we inherited that sin from Adam and Eve, and we the only way to really be free of the sin is through, we're never truly free of it, but through Jesus and through being forgiven and, you know, being honest and truly that Jesus had died for our sins so that we could be reborn. It, for me, it was a spiritual rebirth. It gave me meaning and explanation as to why I've been doing these things and I never understood why I did them. And the idea that humans sin, and that's our natural way, and we have to work every day to follow God's will and to, you know, to put our human, I guess, desires at bay, it was really, really resonated strong for me because I just always said I'm a bad person, I'm terrible. I just didn't know why I did these things, and I had no reason, and it just, the narrative in so many instances in the Bible of people being forgiven and changing and, you know, being reborn in essentially being lost sheep and coming back to their father. You know, that to me was like, I've been lost my whole life. And God has performed this miracle of taking this thing away, right? And it's not fully taken away, but the fact that I'm here a year later is only because of God. And if I was following my own will, I'd keep doing what I was doing. But that humility of saying the way I've done it doesn't work, in letting go and letting God and truly like knowing that I would be okay because I put all my faith and trust in God, and understanding why I sinned and that I was forgiven through Jesus was such a just a relief. I wasn't broken, that I would be okay because you know, I don't know how else to explain it except the narrative of specifically of Christianity and the way my pastor explained why I did these things and how I had to get better through recovery and giving it all to God just was so refreshing and enlightening and new to me that I could give all of it to learning about the Bible. And I started going to church and, you know, reading the Bible and just fully, I'd say, committing to being a moral Christian of values, because I've been living the other way my whole life, and it just got me nowhere. It got me to a place where I almost killed my unborn son. So that to me was like, I mean, I don't have it figured out. I don't know what I'm doing. Please, God, help me. And just giving it all to God. That's the only way I can describe it, Doug.
Yeah. Well, that's a beautiful way to describe it. I think there's several things that you just said that I think are powerful statements. I think of one being that you thought yourself was such a horrible person or a bad person, which I, again, think is just what Satan tells us over and over when we're in our addiction or even in our dark moments now. But Satan wants us to believe we're without the ability to find help. And so just to resign yourself, to take it to the grave, just you're an awful person, try not to mess it up for other people, maybe, you know, and that's like kind of where I resigned myself to in my addiction. And God has a very different narrative than that. And it's a narrative that you just described beautifully, to say that you're broken, but Jesus died on a cross for that already. Like, well before you were a broken person, that has already happened. And I've recently just heard a sermon, I think, or maybe I read it, I don't know where, but I just recently was reading about the prodigal son. And that's just a story that resonates so much from the Bible, I think, with addicts and recovery, just because we know that story from that standpoint. But this was presented in a way I didn't know, and your story made me think of it again. But that son that had been, you know, gone away and squandered his inheritance and lived the party lifestyle, you know, rehearsed this speech of what I want to tell my dad about. Can I just be one of your hired servants? Can I just, you know, do this and work for you? I know you're a kind man to your servants. Let me just be that. Like, he's rehearsing this speech as he's walking back home. But his dad runs to him. And then the person that was writing this or saying the sermon said, and the son never, to our knowledge, got to even do his speech. He never even got to tell his dad, like, here's what I've done, here's how I'm better. His dad didn't care. His dad cared that he was home. And I think, I know that's what recovery is it's God saying, you're home, like, you're back. And so I hear that in your story, and I thank you for sharing that power of that aspect as well.
And God is the Father. God's waiting for us. It's like he rejoices over his one lost sheep. Because we're all his children. And certainly, I knew there was a higher power. I always believed in God, but I didn't practice. And now I truly do understand that God has my back and loves me. I was lost my whole life. Here's the interesting thing about recovery is, sexual sin is one type of sin, but with my life, I had been sinning in so many ways. I had had temper. I had had drug and alcohol abuse. I had been lying. I had been wrathful. I had been greedy. And the whole process of 12 steps and examining your moral inventory, and it's not about being free of sexual compulsive behavior. It's about being the person that you were always meant to be, and leading with love and showing up with kindness and helping others. And it's just changed everything about my life being in recovery, because I know it's most important. And I will say, apart from being free of sexual compulsive behavior, I am also free of many other things that I was leaning on that were out of integrity. And I can truly say, you know, there are certainly days that I do yell. There's certainly days when I do get flustered and anxious, and, you know, I pray, and it's an always, it will always be a standard of which, you know, I cannot live up to, because we are imperfect. But I know my behaviors and my actions are in integrity, and I don't lie anymore. And I do truly try to put my family first and my children and put God first and think about others and love my fellow brothers and sisters in ways that I never could before recovery. It just has changed my entire... I can't say it's changed your personality. That's a little bit strong, but it's changed my value system of what's important, learning about Christianity and learning about what God's will is and what he cares about, what he loves and what he doesn't love, has just given me a whole new lens for which to view my own actions, Doug.
Mm. Sounds like he gave you a new heart. It gave you a new perspective for sure.
I think he gave me the heart he always had given me and lit it up.
Yeah. That's probably much more accurate. Absolutely. So jumping back to what we were saying before where, okay, you're like, okay, this hurt my wife. I need to be in recovery. I'm fine in recovery. But I don't know that I need to say everything because that obviously will hurt her too much. How did you get to the point where you could overcome that? Or what did you do?
So I would call myself a model recovery student. And I say that because I got help in so many ways at so much time that it was going to be very difficult for me to fail because I was literally inundated with recovery. So I told my boss's boss, look, I'm going through some personal challenges. I'm going to need some time to focus on my family. And they were very respectful. And the first thing I did is I was listening to your podcast and they had a polygraph expert on there, and I'm like, oh geez, I'm never going to do that. And I decided, first thing I'm going to do is start going to meetings, SA meetings, and I'm going to find myself a CSAT, because you had said, get an expert. And again, the podcast kind of gave me guidance on what to do. And so I found a CSAT in my area. I had a long interview with her, and I was crying on the phone, just pouring my heart out of all these things that I've done that I've never told anyone. It's like, you need to get in, like, now. And so I got in, and the first question I asked her is, am I going to need to do a disclosure? And she's like, yes, that's part of my programs. And she's like, don't worry, it's not going to be tomorrow. We got to get your wife in here. And I just followed the book. I followed literally the book that I would say would be, and I help men now. I have men call me and they say, what do I do to stop the cycle? And the first thing I say is get a CSAT. And my CSAT kind of guided me and said, you need to get a sponsor and I want you to do a 90-90 program. And so I just at that point immersed myself into recovery. I got a sponsor. I started going through the 12-step programs. I did 90 meetings in 90 days. And I also... very importantly, made sure my wife was involved in the process. And, she was very, very hurt, but she saw that I was willing to get help. And she said, look, and at this point, she didn't know. The only thing she knew was that I had gone on webcam. She said, look, I don't know what's going to happen. I think maybe I'll give it 6 months. We'll have the baby and then we'll figure it out. But, I can't leave you right now because, pregnant and we had our other son before, but it was very uncertain. And so what I said is, please can you come with me to the therapist? Please can you get help yourself? Because I've been reading about trauma and how the partners need help too. And my wife, it was just so difficult. But for the first month, she resisted, maybe the first month and a half, having her own therapist. But my therapist, my CSEC, said, your wife needs to come in to get trauma therapy. And then COVID hit too. And so all these, all these meetings I was going to now became virtual and it was harder to meet in person. But my wife agreed to go in and get her own, betrayal trauma therapist. And so she was getting her therapy. I was getting my therapy. And all of this was leading up to disclosure. And I made the mistake of doing a staggered disclosure where I kind of tell her some things that were, not as bad. In my mind, the Vegas thing was going to be the thing that I told her in the full disclosure, but I didn't want to drop 100 bombs on her. So I kind of would tell her things here and there because she would ask. And I knew I wasn't supposed to, my therapist, but I just felt bad. I felt like I needed to give her something. I didn't want to just say, I can't tell you anything because my therapist said that. And so my you know, the first thing I said is like, she's like, there's no way you have this addiction. You didn't go to strip clubs. Tell me the truth. Did you go to strip clubs during our marriage? And I said, yeah, you know, I did. And she said, how often? Like, I don't know, a few times. And I didn't like tell her the extent. In a couple incidents like that happened where some things, and she, every time she'd get so upset and, you know, we wouldn't talk for a while and then she'd come back and told my therapist and I got slapped for doing that. But I kind of did this gradual disclosure because I felt like I didn't want my wife to have everything dropped on her at once. It would be too hard and, you know, who knows, she could go into labor again. And I went about it the wrong way looking back, but at the time it felt like I had to give her something because I wanted her to know that I was engaged and I didn't want to keep secrets. I said, I can't tell you everything, but here's what I can tell you. But I didn't tell her about the massage parlors. I didn't tell her that I had gone on camera on the webcams, that it was two way. And I didn't tell her that, you know, I'd gone prostitutes once. And so that, you know, was basically, you know, a few months after the initial February 13th, it was maybe a month and a half, but there was so much pain and there was so much like fighting and upsetness in our house. I mean, she was crying every night. She couldn't sleep. It was awful those first month or two after disclosure. And I'm like, we have to get to disclosure. I cannot keep these secrets anymore. I can't keep this festering basically, any longer. And so I rushed my therapist to get to the disclosure because it was just too painful to keep to keep hiding stuff, knowing now I wanted to be out in the open, you know, and she still didn't know everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can relate to so much of that. And I know other testimonies that we've recorded have a similar feeling to that, where it's like this disclosure process, we're seeking freedom now. We're seeking to get rid of it. And so we, you know, unfortunately we put it on the back of spouses and on so many other people that we hurt. But this idea of, you know, death by 1,000 paper cuts, that sounds trivial for what this is, but like those many disclosures all along the way are so hard. And that's a really awkward time between discovery and disclosure. So, you know, you're found out, that's discovery. Disclosure is telling all. That's a really awkward time. But so if you're a listener and you're maybe approaching that time or you're in that time, you know, seek the wise counsel of a CSAT. And, you know, hopefully your spouse also has that same ability to do that and to be able to do it the best way possible. There's no good way. There's no way that doesn't have a lot of pain and a lot of awkwardness and a lot of hard, but that might help. And looking back in Ian and your story, you're doing the best you can, right? I mean, it's
that's right.
You've got to give grace to yourself to know, like, yeah, I had a lot of mistakes in my life, and so consequences are all over the place, and I'm just doing the best I can to try to start to rectify this one step at a time. And it sounds like you did some really powerful things, some things that were just like, you know what, I don't have control of my own life anymore. I'm going to listen to what a sponsor tells me to do. I'm going to listen to a CSAT tells me to do. I'm going to listen to other guys in meetings and do what they say. And that's why 90 and 90 works. 90 meetings in 90 days is a pretty common way when you jump into recovery to do that. Now, I say it's common because you hear it said a lot. It's not common because most guys don't do a full 90 and 90. But the reason that's so powerful is being able to hear over and over and over other guys that are walking through the same thing that you are, other ways that people are dealing with it, other ways to show intimacy in ways that you didn't know were possible. So if that's you and you're like, I just don't even know what to do next, just start going to meetings. Just start picking up the telemeetings. Start picking up meetings in your area, wherever they are, to be able to start to find out that you're not alone. So it sounds like that's a powerful piece of your story as well.
Yeah, this was what I was doing every day during disclosure. I also preceding just disclosure. I also sold my car. I gave her my ATM card, and you know, she basically gave me a list of conditions that I had to do. She was going to stay with me, and of course, I was with open arms, willing to do anything. Because at this point, she's still pregnant. We have our 4-year-old. It was just so painful for us to be, you know, in this state and having a child and a pregnant wife. I was just, at this point, I mean, I can only describe it as like pure humility. You know, I was so like just broken down that I would have done anything to keep my family together. So I, you know, proceeded to try and rush to disclosure, and I wrote down, you know, all the things, basically writing a disclosure letter of all the things I'd done. And in chronological order, I had to go back and look at all my credit card statements and pull up bank statements and request things, because it was so, she didn't just want what we did during marriage, she wanted before marriage, she wanted totals that I had spent. It took a lot of time and investigative research to even figure out what I had done, because, you know, I had anonymized it and I had really hit it. So I went through that process of writing every letter, and I included everything. I knew I was going to do a polygraph. I knew that was part of the process, and I did not want to hide anything. So I included every detail, even things that I thought would be remotely questionable, I put in there just to be safe and know that I wasn't hiding anything. And about a week before the disclosure, I come home, and my wife again is furious, and she's crying and she's devastated. I'm like, what happened? And she said, I saw your disclosure documents. And so, you know, we were waiting to do it in a clinical setting, but she had gone on my computer when I went out and stepped out to go somewhere for a little bit. And, I made the mistake of not locking that document. And unfortunately, she saw at this point, I hadn't finished writing it and I hadn't gotten to Vegas or some of the stuff, but a lot of other stuff was on there. And she just said, I'm done with the process. I'm not going to disclosure. I don't want to do it anymore. I can't be with you. And, you know, I just thought that was it, you know. She told me she was leaving me. And I thought it ruined the whole thing. And I started getting defensive. I said, why couldn't you just follow this process? You know, we told not to look at it. How could you do this? And I realized now, like, this was her way of coping. She was still being traumatized and she just wanted to find answers. So she got in this like hyper vigilant stage of trying to figure out everything, including going to my computer. So I should have locked it. In hindsight, for anyone who's doing that, make sure you lock your document, because that to me was a major setback in our, you know, in our process, where then she didn't even want to go through the disclosure process. And so, you know, fortunately, you know, again, God, we prayed about it and God got her to go through the process, and she agreed, because in my mind I was like, let's follow what works. My CSAT told me 90% of the people that go through this process and go through disclosure end up staying together, and that was just, for me, it was so like encouraging, and I just was leaning on that. So the fact that she didn't want to go through it to me was like we were gonna not make it. And so you know, I remember that was a setback, and we end up finally getting to the disclosure, and I tell her everything, and, you know, it took hours. We were there. It was me and three women, both the therapist, her therapist, and my therapist, the women. It was just so difficult to like read on paper all the things I had done, but I did. And my wife was obviously very upset during that process. I told her everything. And interestingly, the thing that I thought was upset her the most is, didn't. It was not that. It was one of the times I flirted with the woman and took my ring off, and, you know, I put that on there and I had my arm around a woman that wasn't my wife, and she's like, that's cheater behavior. That wasn't a prostitute. That wasn't a paid person. That was a woman that you probably would have done something with when you were out, you know. And there were all kinds of things in that disclosure. Literally things that I had forgotten about that were so telling after the fact that showed me how deep I was in my addiction. One time we were traveling out of town and we were staying in a hotel together, but instead of being in the hotel together, I actually came in and didn't go home. I went to a massage parlor and then went to the hotel. I didn't even remember I had done that, you know? Mm-hmm. So, part of my conditions for staying with my wife was never to get drunk and, you know, to give away my ATM card, to put filters on my phone, to check in with her every night. So my therapist basically said, here's what you have to do. And if you follow this process, obviously work my steps, go to my meetings, don't miss a meeting. And I just was a model student. I did it to a T. And, you know, after disclosure, my wife left me briefly. I forgot to mention, during this whole process, she kicked me out of the house, but it was COVID. And we're fortunate where I'm very successful in business and I have a large house and a guest house in the back, and I was sleeping in my guest house. And it was the hardest thing in the world, but I was sober the whole time. I was praying the whole time. And after disclosure, you know, she basically was okay for a couple days. And she said, you know, I can't be with you, Ian. And she took my son and she left me. And she's like, I got to go to my parents. I don't know how long I'm going to be there. I don't know what's going to happen. And she left me at that point.
That's such a hard part of the story, and knowing, you know, that there's unknown in walking out there, that, yes, there's stats that are out there that 9 out of 10 people that go through that process do rectify their marriage, but there's still a 10% chance that it's not. And so, like I've said on this podcast before, it's a moment where you truly have to decide, do I want my wife to stay because she doesn't know everything? Or do I want to tell her everything and let that be her choice to stay or not? And so that is your wife's ability now to start to wrestle with that and let between her and God decide what is the next step she needs to take. And I'm grateful, you know, that you were able to say, I'm going to put honesty as number one, that you were going to dive in and do what other more wise people in recovery at the moment said to do. There were several times in my recovery that I was like, you want me to do what? And it didn't make sense to me, but I just did it because someone said to do it. But that's our own broken thinking, and that's just part of that recovery process. And I like the ideas that you showcased or told, that it really was so much more than just dealing with the sexual improprieties, that it's about character. It's about your own integrity. It's about seeing yourself as someone that can be used for God and not someone that's just destined to be a bad person. And that's the process of sanctification. That's what the 12 steps really do. And I think that was brought out clearly in your story.
Yeah. And so the story does have a happy ending, at least for now. And it will have a happy ending, in that my wife left and she was gone almost a week, and she didn't want to talk to me, and that was one of the hardest weeks of my life because I didn't know she was going back. But I let her have her space, and she ended up coming back. And she came back not because she wanted to be with me, but because her mom had been driving her crazy staying over there. And, you know, my son's on the autism spectrum, and, you know, he was having a really tough time. He's only 4 years old, and obviously he sensed something was wrong. And they were staying there, and it was away from his home. And so she's like, you know what, I got to get back. I can't be around this environment. And, you know, she had gotten in a fight with her mom and then came back home. And I was just like, thank you, God, you know, for sending her back. I don't care why. I don't want her to fight, but I'm glad she's here. And I think that was kind of the beginning of the uphill, because she knew about the disclosure and she still decided to come back. Because I, at that point, I didn't know. It was a short period, but I really didn't know what would happen. But I knew that I was going to be sober regardless of whether or not she came back, because even when she left during those, you know, those very long days, I didn't want to act out. I went to my meetings. I was committed to recovery, because I knew that I would have zero chance of getting her back if I went back to my old ways, that's for sure. So she came back, and you know, it's taken a while. That was back in April of last year, probably, you know, I would say 3 months after I came out, we were in a place where we said, okay, we're gonna try to work through this. And she was very pregnant at the time, and I just was committed to making sure that I could help her on the house and put her first, and, you know, be supportive. And it just, like, nothing mattered except keeping my marriage and keeping my recovery. That was it. So we fortunately had our baby during COVID, and I put everything else aside. You know, I said, this is the most important thing. My work can wait. Everything else can wait. And I went on paternity leave and spent 3 months with my wife, helping, you know, really, you know, contribute with our baby and Max, and just making sure that we were completely unified. And I think what she's seen is that I'm different. She knows I'm not perfect. She knows I still have my flaws, but she knows also that I'm committed to being honest, and that, you know, I've just done different things around the house that have helped my marriage, like cooking at night and helping her clean and take care of the baby. And I think that's just so much a big part of recovery, is not just stopping acting out, but becoming a different person that puts your family first versus puts your own selfish interests first.
Yeah.
For me, that's been kind of, I think, key to reconciling with my wife, is just showing her that I'm different.
Yeah. I can think in our readings that we do in Castamonio, one of the things that's said is that, you know, the result of was nil until we let go absolutely. And I've talked about that on the podcast before, but that we will have no result in our recovery unless we let go absolutely, which means fully, to recovery. And that's exactly what you were talking about, that we let go of the worries of work or the pressures of other things to say, this is the most important thing, and this is what I have to do. And we're imperfect, and man, I mess up all the time. But trying to just say, I'm all in with this, is really the only way. And I've seen a lot of guys that want to dip their toe in the water of recovery. And man, I have a heart for them, and I want them to find recovery. And I wish the toe dipping worked, but it just doesn't. And like, you have to be all in. And that's scary, and it's really scary, but there's better on the other side, and that's why I like these testimonies and why I like Part B. It's not because it just highlights that you got to go all in to save your marriage, because that may be true, but there's so much more than that. Like, you've got to go all in to save yourself, to become better, to actually enjoy life, because it sounds like all of a sudden you have enjoyment. You're proud of yourself. You're proud of who you are. I would hope now that when you look in the mirror, and I'll put words in your mouth, that you're not saying I'm a bad person anymore, that you're seeing yourself as a child of God. That's recovery.
What I'm most proud of, Doug, is that I'm honest, and I'm putting others first. I don't spend time. My recovery has been more than giving up pornography. I have not smoked pot. I have not gotten drunk. I have not gambled, played a video game, and I stopped taking Adderall during this process. And I realized that, you know, I didn't want to move from one addiction to another, and that these were all symptoms of me being stressed and anxious and overwhelmed. I'm just more in tune with my body, where I know what I'm feeling, the preceding symptoms that would previously have led me to act out. Those are, because I'm not doing all these other things, I'm getting to the root of the problem. So instead of, like, you know, when I feel that, I know I need to take on a little less. I know I need to connect a little more, you know. I need to get out of my head and, you know, right, spend time with my family. So it's really like this, my whole life, I felt like I was just medicating. And I'd say for any addicts, you know, sexual recovery is one symptom, but true recovery is avoiding sexual acting out is certainly important. But, like, doing that work on yourself and realizing, like, what makes you act out in the first place, or what stresses you, or what causes that those feelings that make you want to escape is equally important. And that's kind of where the work is now for me, is just like trying to be mindful and aware of how I'm feeling. And kind of, it was like before, it was like always all in or all out. Now I'm like a healthy middle ground where I go a little up, a little down, but for the most part, I don't feel that, you know, just all in or all out place that I used to live.
Well, that's a great way to say it, and that's a great place to start to do a wrap-up. But I would love for you to say, what is a big tool that now, currently in your recovery, you say, this is a tool that I use in my recovery that I would love to pass on to other men? What would you say that is?
Yeah, so I think the question is, now that you're a year, you know, sober, you know, how do you maintain and keep recovery top of mind and make it part of your life? And for me, the tool is prayer and God. I mean, the tool is praying every day and making sure that I'm continuing to understand and to read scripture, even if it's just a little daily scripture or once a week with church, whatever I can do to go to God and to remind myself of what's important. Pray when I need it. Prayer is really important. That's my number one tool, is prayer, because it keeps me connected to God, and especially when I need help, because we all need help all the time. Our friends and family need help too, and the world needs help. And so I just turn to prayer every day. It's a habit that I have, and it's something important. And then the second tool I would say is just, you know, paying it forward. Right now I'm taking in sponsors, so being able to teach and help other men, and making yourself, when you give to others, in any capacity, just giving is a tool, you receive. And before I was receiving through indulging, and now I'm receiving through sharing and through helping and through service. So, I still try to maintain my, I still go to my therapist. I saw her yesterday, even though it's a year later. I'm still continuing to go to therapy. I still meet with my sponsor every week. I still go to meetings, albeit it's not every day. I have my two main meetings I go to every week. Combined with therapy, that's three meetings a week. So keeping three meetings a week, going to church, having prayer, making sure that I'm giving, sponsoring other men and paying it forward and teaching others and helping others that are in need for me. Those are all been tools that I'm very active today in keeping me sober. But my number one tool is prayer. That by far is for me very effective.
I think that's great advice. I appreciate you sharing that. I think it's wise because it slows us down. It slows us down to get out of our own head, like you were saying, where we can let space for God to speak, let space to see the needs of others around us. So I just think it's just that action of not being selfish. And so I appreciate you sharing that.
And I think meetings too, Doug, right? Just continuing. I'm not reading the books all the time. I'm not doing the worksheets right now. I'm not immersed in recovery. I'm immersed in my family and my work and other things, but recovery is just part of who I am. So sharing my story and going to meetings and speaking out to help other people and being an example, for me, that's just so important because it keeps it alive. When you admit it constantly and you share it constantly, it reminds you of why this is so important to continue doing the work. So just being, vocal and sharing and helping other men and sharing your story without shame. It just, for me, it's just been, even coming on this podcast, it's like, I got teary-eyed a few times because I was in such a dark place when I first heard your voice and George's voice. And now here we are a year later. And it just feels so, I'm just so grateful to be where I'm at. And I'd encourage every man just to, whoever's listening, where you're struggling, just follow what works, get a CSAT, follow what they tell you. And if you want to, truly, truly set yourself free, follow the path that's been laid before you and let it go to God. And it works. It works if you work it. I'm still working. I'm on step 9 now and, making my amends and just amazing. How I feel a year later and how free I feel knowing that I'm free of this thing that I don't want to act down anymore. I don't think about it. It's just, I have better habits and better ways of living that I couldn't imagine ever going back to what I was doing before. This has not been white knuckling at all. This has been truly, truly, true recovery and transformation, personal transformation, spiritual rebirth.
Well, I appreciate your honesty. I appreciate your vulnerability. And I know that there are men out there that are going to hear this, they're going to connect to it, and they're going to be better for it. They're going to deepen their connection with God. They're going to deepen their recovery, or maybe they're going to realize their rock bottom just happened and they need to find recovery. So whatever that is, whatever the listeners out there, we're praying that that message lands that way. And if you're somebody out there that's like, I need to tell my story. I need to start to undo some shame. Telling your story works. And hey, why not just do it on a podcast? Sometimes that can feel like a big step. But you can email us at puritypodcast@castamonia.org and do that. And Ian, again, just thank you so much for telling your story. Thank you so much for sharing the darkness. But more importantly, thanks for sharing the hope of how you found the light, how you found the ability to walk in freedom. And it's not easy. It's not ever perfect, but we are doing it together. And so that's why I'll close out like I close out all the podcasts, that we're all walking on this road together. And it's a tough road. It's a tough road of recovery, but we are not walking alone.